Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum, the podcast about all things undisclosed. I am John Cryer. I'll be your host for this evening. We have Dennis Robinson here, who is the producer of Undisclosed. We have Susan Simpson, associate at the Volkov Law Group. And we have the lovely Rabia Chaudhry here. She is a fellow at the U.S. Institute for Peace, as well as New America here. By the way, I've never been to a think tank before. When I first came in, I heard this hum, and I thought, oh, that's people thinking. That's wonks thinking fiercely, but it's actually the air conditioning. And ladies and gentlemen, Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Rabia just got asked to be a part of the Muslim Jewish Advisory Council.
Right, which, National
yes,
Council.
Yes, yes. Now, could you tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
Yeah, so this, first of all, good evening, everybody. Thank you guys for coming, and thanks to New America for having us. This is really exciting, and we're going to hopefully not totally destroy this doing it live, our first time live. Yeah, so this is, especially given like the what's happened in the last week or so, this is a national-level Jewish-Muslim advisory council that was brought together by two organizations that ordinarily never work together, ever. A Muslim organization and a Jewish organization that have no history of working together, and there's a lot of complications when even now they're trying. We've been working on this for a couple of months now to bring together a diverse group of leaders who are going to actually try to make policy changes that are going to impact both of our communities. Things like immigration, things like hate crimes, all kinds of things that hopefully won't come to pass, but we feel like we have to be really vigilant right now. So I'm excited about it, and it's a real honor to be on the council.
Well, yes, when I heard, I thought, so she's going to be on that whole Muslim-Jewish thing. It'll be solved in a couple of weeks. So I was very excited about that. So we're very excited to be here live, but news, it just keeps happening and keeps overtaking us. I had been actually meaning to ask everybody about what their feelings were about the news about Brendan Dassey's being ordered released. But then just moments before this afternoon, we found out that he is actually not being released. A court has ordered that he remain incarcerated until his appeal is decided. And I thought it was, I was going to ask, you know, being that the popular context of the acceptance of whether people are wrongfully, whether the public feels that they're wrongfully convicted or not is such a vital component of these things, I was going to ask, do you think that would affect Adnan Syed's situation?
I almost think that once you get a certain level of awareness and public sort of standing, this is not scientific, but it seems like it makes it harder. Because you look at the cases where, you know, there's a name there, Adnan, Brendan Dassey, Stephen Avery, and they're fighting back every step of the way. Whereas I was interviewing one recent exoneree, and I was asking how he felt being from a state with another famous exoneree, and he's like, actually, we're kind of grateful, because we under the radar. The prosecutor looked at the case, you know, they filed a motion, they filed an appeal, but after a little bit, they're like, you know what? We're going to close this out and let you go because we don't see anything to do here. And he did not think that would have happened had his case gotten a level of public awareness that other cases had. So yeah, I think it can actually work against these people in some senses.
Yeah, because the conventional wisdom is that these people, if public awareness wasn't made of their case, they'd have no hope.
And it helps, definitely helps. But I also think there's a sort of a counterweight there too.
I was going to say, I was on a panel with Stephen Drizin, who is Brendan Dassey's attorney, just a couple of days ago. And he spoke to Brendan right before we began speaking. And he said that, you know, he told Brendan that it looks like he's going to have him home by Thanksgiving. And we were all just really happy to hear that and heartened to hear that. And then yesterday we heard that he was going to be ordered, to be home by Friday, tomorrow. It is Thursday, right? Yeah. And then today this happened. So, you know, it's really heartbreaking. But on that panel, one of the things that we explored, and there are other attorneys who have been dealing with this, is the fact that although I personally think that it might give the court more incentive to pay more attention to these cases, I also think it gives incentive for the states to fight back harder. And I think that's what we're seeing. I think we're seeing in Adnan's case. And so that is the downside of it, the attention.
When they lose, people know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in terms of the emotional effect that this has to have on somebody who's incarcerated and dealing with that, I mean, that roller coaster has to be brutal. Has he been hearing a lot of the things going on?
Yeah, and it's interesting because Adnan learns a lot about what's happening in his case from the media directly, because, you know, we don't have a system where we can just pick up a phone and call him and inform him of something. If he calls us, if he calls his attorney, or if his attorney can schedule something, but it takes a couple of days sometimes. So oftentimes he'll learn from the news what's happening. He'll learn from other inmates who saw the news, guards. And so far it's been okay. There have been times when he's been a little bit concerned because if you go too hard, like, for example, talking about the conditions, the incarceration, all these things, like, he worries that it will impact his relationships with people inside the prison. So, you know, I've kind of backed off on talking about, like, the prison conditions themselves and things like that. I don't want to put him in that position. But I think even in Joey's case, we were worried that as this case got more attention, that we didn't want him to be mistreated. So, so far, Adnan seems to be doing okay, but I don't know how Joey's doing on these issues.
Joey is fortunate in that he's one of possibly the only prison in Georgia that's somewhat progressive or humane in how it handles prisoners. So he's lucky in that respect, and hopefully it'll continue to go well for him.
Has his emotional health been okay? I mean, I imagine hope is actually kind of scary for people in that situation.
I can definitely tell a difference from when we started this case and I first started talking to him. He seemed more zen about it. And I can tell in recent months there's more, I don't want to say anxiety, that's the wrong word, but there's more hope, I guess, which is not always an easy thing to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a burden in some way, I'm sure. But actually, there's been some movement. You guys have filed for a release of the Watkins trial audio. Actually, I don't know if you guys remember, but inexplicably, the state has refused to hand over the audio of his trial. Do you want to give a little background on that?
Yeah, so we've been fortunate enough to obtain copies of the free trial tapes. So from Mark Free's trial, which was in February 2002, so that's the audio you're hearing on the podcast. When you hear trial audio being played, that's not from Joey's trial, it's from Mark's trial. It's a long story in itself, and actually they apparently have recently asked to get that audio back from us. Yeah. Let's see how that goes for him. Because
you can just, can recall it. You know, it's people can unhear it now.
Yeah, but so the tapes for Joey Watkins' trial and preliminary hearing and his bond hearing, that they actually initially said, yes, you can record it. And Claire and the GIP got to work on that and then realized that they had the wrong equipment because it was some kind of old school four track. I don't even know what it's called, but it was complicated, and everyone sounds like a demented chipmunk, so it's not going to work for us. So they're like, okay, we'll come back with a new equipment, and in that time, somehow it was decided that they are not going to allow us to have any of the Watkins trial tapes, so we tried a few ways to get around that. It didn't work, and then we have some wonderful attorneys at Kaplan Cobb who are representing us now, and they filed a motion.
Us, you mean undisclosed as a
yes.
part of this?
Yes.
So that's cool.
Although, so I was kind of sad because I wanted it to be like undisclosed versus Georgia, which would have been super cool. But they filed it under Joey's case, so it's still Watkins versus Georgia. But the original motion was denied. The court, a new judge, Judge Sparks, just appointed to replace the judge. It actually was at Joey's and Mark's trial. He just retired. And he said that, you know what, you're right, this is a public record. This audio is something that's subject to Rule 21 under the Georgia court rules. So you have to allow public access, but the rule says you're allowed to inspect it. Nothing in there about copying. So you can come to the court, pay us some money, and listen to it. But you can't copy it, and that's it. In fact, his order actually said, like, in capital, like, not copy it. So that's, you know, okay, that's not going to work for our purposes, and also totally defeats the entire purpose of having open records and public disclosures. So after that came in, Kaplan Cobb filed an expedited motion to either amend the court's order or application for leave to appeal it. That was filed this week and is currently pending, so hopefully we'll get some traction there. And I'd love to have the Supreme Court of Georgia look at this and say, you know what, this is really messed up. And then on the other hand, like, if we lose this, we actually kind of just lost people in the in Georgia the right to like ever copy any records, because the courts
that would be a downside. Yeah, that would be
because the court's order didn't just apply to audio. The court's order said that any kind of court record you can only inspect. There's no right to copy it. So theoretically, if we lost, that means that from now on in Georgia, you have to go to a court, like go to a room and look at it. But you can never take a copy back with you.
That would be a crazy precedent.
Yeah.
We are coming to you live today from New America, where we are taping a live undisclosed addendum with John and the whole team here, Colin joining us via Skype. But I want to take a quick break to talk to you about one of our sponsors. The Undisclosed team has been fans of the Great Courses Plus for quite a while now. We've all enjoyed watching so many of their different courses and learned a lot. And we really want you to discover the Great Courses Plus too. So they're offering our listeners an opportunity to get a full month of free video courses when you sign up using our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. The Great Courses Plus has amazing video lectures from award-winning professors. It's great for people who like to learn, definitely people who like to listen to our podcast because, you know, our podcast is pretty heavy on information and knowledge. And they offer a range of courses, depending on your interests, that can satisfy anybody. All kinds of topics, psychology, history, art, photography, and lots more. If you've been following us online, you might have noticed that last night I had an undisclosed dinner at my house. Had the whole team over, and I love to cook for my friends. If you're somebody who likes to cook or just learning the ropes, make sure to check out the Great Courses Plus course, Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking. It was created in partnership with the Culinary Institute of America with Master Chef Briwa. And it's perfect right in time before your holiday entertaining. With the Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, from your mobile device, tablet, laptop, or TV. So sign up today to get 1 month free as one of our listeners and definitely check out Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking so you can wow your guests this holiday season. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed.
Well, but a lot of the time when precedents get set like that, lawyers just ignore it. it was just a weird thing. It's considered bad law. A friend of mine who was in law school was telling me about this. He said, yeah, there's stuff that they just mark and it's like nobody pays attention to it, which sounds nuts to me.
It depends on, practice and like the history of practice for like courtrooms often kind of controls. And that's not like the rules or the law, just like the habits. Like everyone's always done it this way, so everyone always does it this way. Which is why this issue has not been actually litigated before. No one's actually brought it. Well, in recent years, actually, in Georgia, it's been an issue that's coming up, and it's probably part of why it was denied here. But the courts just always operated the way they always had, and however they chose to do it is how everyone in that jurisdiction kept doing it. So it's not actually gone to the Supreme Court prior to now.
So is there any case law that supports what you are trying to do? I don't know if would Colin care to weigh in on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting talking about Freedom of Information Act and open records requests is actually, that's a relatively new phenomenon. It was in the 70s, and actually it was over a veto by President Ford. And one of the main cases cited in our brief for disclosure and the ability to copy these records is a case involving Richard Nixon. And that, I think, is probably the strongest case actually in there supporting freedom of the press in this and the ability to copy these records and air them to be able to show to the public what's going on. So, yeah, I think that Nixon case, the Supreme Court case, is maybe the strongest one, and it comes from the state's highest court, the federal Supreme Court.
But isn't that a federal law as opposed to a state law? I mean, if it was Nixon, I imagine it wouldn't have been happened in Georgia.
Right. Well, it's a First Amendment case, so it is the Supreme Court interpreting the First Amendment, which then through the incorporation doctrine has effect on the state. So, in other words, if there's this First Amendment right to access and publicity and disclosure, that would apply in Georgia or any other state.
Ah. Okay.
Mike's work. Okay. Is that this is like an issue that as somebody who has not practiced criminal law, when I realized in so many states, like, you know, the public does not have access to video or audio recordings of what happens inside, like, public proceedings in a courtroom. Like, it's been shocking for me, even in Maryland. So, for example, the PCR hearing that just took place with Adnan, that's 5 days of video footage of what happened in the courtroom. His lawyer has it, but his lawyer is prevented under Maryland state law from actually disclosing it, to giving it to the public, from disseminating it. And you have to ask yourself why. The public's allowed to attend the trial. These are open. Like, why is there still a lack of transparency? And so sometimes when people ask, well, what can we do? I'm like, you know, in your state level, like, that's a really important point that I think if there's a way to make changes in laws, is to make these types of, like, video recordings, first of all, mandatory in because not all courts even allow videotaping in the thing, but also make them accessible to the public. There's just no excuse for it.
I mean, it's the whole point of the Constitution and the open courts. I mean, they didn't have podcasts back then, but I'd like to think if they had, they would have understood that's part of the right of open courts. Like, they want people to be there to tell about what they saw, because it's the only way they had to sort of make sure everyone could see what happened in the courtroom. It wasn't just a only people in the courtroom kind of rule. Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, you know, very high profile trials like the OJ trial and situations like that, that's a different situation because that we're talking about a trial that's already taken place. You know, I think part of the reason, the reticence that they might have to release things probably has to do with not wanting to create an entertainment style atmosphere. I can imagine it's probably just sort of a knee jerk. Let's not, you know, if we can choose between putting it out or not, let's not.
I think there are a lot of motives for this, and they're not always the same ones, but there are, I mean, one of the big cases in Georgia recently that came about, and that's sort of the background of this whole litigation now, involves a case where what was heard in the courtroom of people there did not match the transcripts. And there are a few, not just Georgia, other states too, where, in fact, one of the exonerations that happened recently, this involved, like, they had to get multiple affidavits from people in the courtroom to say, actually, no, this is what we heard, because for some strange reason, the transcript didn't have it.
Yeah, well, and this happens all the time. I mean, obviously, stenographers are human beings and they make errors. But there's no mechanism for repairing. I mean, is there a mechanism?
Well, in Georgia right now. A recent case is sort of part of the current set of litigations going on, involved a court, I want to say Paulding, but I'm not sure of that, where the judge actually said the N-word in open court. That did not make it into the transcript. So a reporter asked for the audio, and the court, the transcript person doing the transcription of it, the court clerk said, nope, can't have it. Here's the transcript. It's not in there. Cool. So he wrote an article about this and said, like, well, here's what happened. Here's what I asked it for. And I didn't get it. The transcript doesn't have it. People in the courtroom heard it. So she sued him. The court reporter sued him for defamation. Meanwhile, the judge who did this, he's off the bench because, well, before a recent election, Georgia had an independent body that evaluated judges. It's now been neutered and put under the government's control, Congress's control. So this lawsuit happens, and it goes away, but the court reporter gets her attorney's fees paid by the court, which it was unsure if that's what should have happened or what was going on there. So the same reporter says, well, I'm going to request the court records, like the court financial records, to see what was going on. And he did his little open records request saying, give me your financial showing if you paid for the court fees or the attorney's fees for this court reporter. So he does that, and the new judge has him arrested for identity theft.
Okay. you lost me. I don't get how that one. But whose identity was stolen?
I don't understand. Financial info from the court, and the court thought that was him trying to. Well, that was allegedly he was trying to steal financial information to commit some kind of identity theft or fraud. Who knows? Uh-huh. So he was, you know, arrested, jailed, but got out.
Okay.
And yeah, and he never got the audio, so he still doesn't have the audio from the original hearing.
Did they ever talk about what the context of saying that was? I mean, he wasn't, you know, greeting a friend or something like that. I don't know. I'm just throwing something out there.
Well,
you never know.
So I don't know all the details of the underlying issue there, but I do know apparently there was someone in the court. There was a black guy who worked in the court, I think, and that was like he just went by N-word name.
Wow. In what year was this, may I ask?
2015.
Okay. No, this is 1927, actually. That's every now and then you run across pretty startling things like that.
Georgia.
Yes, Georgia. Yes. Now, so there was a body that was overseeing these things, but it recently got put under the control of Congress.
The state legislature. The amendment.
Oh, the state legislature.
Yeah. Amendment
okay.
3. It was on the ballot, and it was a very confusingly worded issue. And I can see why it won. It's not because people actually wanted to not have an independent body overseeing judges. It's that it looked like a good idea when you phrase it the way they did.
Uh-huh.
Which was like to allow for some public access to like the Judicial Qualifications Division, mm-hmm. which kind of implies there was none before, but there was. Now there's going to be much less.
Okay. Episode 17 of Undisclosed was Informants and Wiretaps, and it was an in-depth investigation of Detective Sutton's recruitment and use of three particular jailhouse informants. I was so grateful for this episode, I don't know about you folks, because I had no idea the various permutations of how jailhouse informants actually come to do this kind of stuff. And I realized that if I was a member of the jury, and I had heard two informants actually confirming the others, I would probably believe it, absent this kind of knowledge, because I would be like, oh, well, two of them have very similar stories, but it would not even occur to me that they might just talk it over and figure out how they're gonna do that. We had a question for social media actually from at My Cosima who asks, is it common to have so many jailhouse informants come forward and want to testify on a case?
No.
Because how many were there?
In total informants, I mean, so they had six that were either like, I think five ultimately came to court maybe. Either through Mark's trial or forwarded through Joey's trial. Then there was more that, so there were a bunch of like jailhouse, not they were on the witness list. Like these guys are named by the prosecutor and like listed on like state's witnesses, typed up all formally. And they didn't show up, they didn't actually appear at court. And when I contacted them, they were like, oh yeah, I remember that case. I was locked up with the dude who did it or supposedly did it. He never said anything though. they were trying a lot of angles. They actually, when Mark was in jail for his third probation violation that year, on his last day there, they pulled out 34, I think, 30 plus inmates to question them about whether they'd heard Mark confess.
Which is just an enormous amount of work. That's one of the things that has always... surprised me about this particular investigation is they poured a lot of resources into this. Obviously, you know, it was an unusual, killing, but it seems it just seemed odd to me, you know, that you have, you know, the Georgia, the GBI and the FBI and every possible resource thrown at this one particular case.
Yeah.
It's just
it's odd.
I got it. It might have something to do with Stanley Sutton's connection to the family too. I mean, like his commitment to getting a conviction. Susan knows more about that. But the other thing, like what's odd to me is the fact that like you make an arrest, right? You assume you make an arrest because you already have the evidence, you know, that can prove that this guy did it. So, but in this case, you're like, we've made the arrest. Now we're going to look for the evidence, and we can't find anything. So let's find jailhouse. So I am always going to be skeptical when like that's your evidence comes after you have decided who it is and you've made the charge and made the arrest and, you know, press charges.
Is it incumbent upon police officers when they're, and detectives obviously, when they're doing these investigations to make some sort of judgment on the quality of the evidence? I mean, it has to be. I mean, is that in this case, it appears that Detective Sutton used the jailhouse informants as a means to get a wiretap. Despite the fact that there were huge evidentiary holes in what they were saying, first of all, is that considered acceptable amongst police officers? And then, if it isn't, is there any recourse for bringing them, you know, bringing that up and having some sort of discipline taken out on them?
Well, as for what it's supposed to be, no, this is not what it's supposed to be. But like, as for recourse, Colin probably weigh in.
Is there any recourse, Colin?
No, I mean, not really for the police. A prosecutor could be disciplined for suborning perjury, but that happens exceedingly rarely. In terms of the police, I mean, if they make up an informant to get an affidavit and to get a search warrant or arrest warrant, that would lead to discipline. But you never really see any type of discipline for a police officer relying upon a tenuous or unreliable informant when they're submitting that application.
Is that because police officers generally get conflicting information? I mean, let's face it, people's memories conflict all the time. I mean, so somebody could, you know, in good faith, give a witness statement that conflicts with evidence that the police already have, and still have some useful information. Correct.
I like how we're both looking at Colin. Like,
yes, I'm looking at Colin. Like, I know, like he can see me. He can't see me.
Yeah, when you look at it, the Innocence Project stats, 15% of those DNA exonerations are based upon informant testimony, with the informants being incentivized. And despite that, there have been one or two prosecutors in the last decade who are disciplined for these wrongful convictions. It's even less with police officers. The amount of credibility and faith we put in their judgment is so high that you just don't see. I mean, the cases you see are really literally this informant was a fabrication. There wasn't an informant, period. You don't see cases where there's any type of discipline based upon a police officer putting too much faith in an unreliable informant.
Well, yes. And when your informant is telling you that supposed murderer wanted to use their truck to push another truck fast enough to make the truck burn up, it does beggar belief. I mean, but everybody knows that if you can get the truck going 88 miles per hour and you can get a lightning bolt to hit it, then the flux capacitor will work and you can go back to the 50s. Or to 2015.
keep in mind, Mark Free is standing in the back of that truck bed this yes, whole time. So yes. Like,
yes. For those of you who didn't hear the latest episode, there is one of the jailhouse informants tells a story that so completely beggars belief that
you don't know that. You don't know that. It could have happened that way.
It could have. You're right. You're right.
I want that audio. I want to hear what Sutton sounds like when he's defending Beckstein.
Exactly. You're right, and you had that bit of the transcript of him sort of defending him, saying, "Well, it's possible."
No, he says it could have been a lot of things. You never know.
Uh huh. Yeah, but he was able to get a wiretap on the basis of that, and that's a real civil liberties issue. You know, if a police officer can do that. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, he may well have believed these informants. I have no evidence to the contrary.
Well, he pulled the toll records. He did subpoena, like, Joey's and this David Brown, who's Mark's friend. It has nothing to do with anything. His home phone records and Joey's home phone records and all the jail pay phones. So we could see there were no calls that matched what Beckstein was describing. So he knew. Or he just never looked at it after pulling a lot of records and paying a lot of money for it. So I don't think that happened. He knew.
And again, there's no recourse in that situation, Colin?
No, I mean, you're really looking at there wasn't even an informant, and that's the case you can never
Somebody has to be invisible.
Keep repeating it. You do not see cases where there's any type of discipline or recourse against a police officer when they have relied. I mean, there's actually an informant instruction that's given in court that says, going to your point, John, before, if you were in the courtroom as a juror, how much credibility would you give these jailhouse informants? There's actually an instruction, and we discussed in our first season case how tough it is to prove ineffective assistance of counsel. One of those rare circumstances beyond failure to contact an alibi witness where you have ineffective assistance is where an attorney in an informant case does not ask for this instruction because it's so critical to convey to jurors these are not reliable witnesses. And then that, of course, then gives deference to the prosecutor and the police officer because we all know informants are not reliable, so you can't really judge too harshly the police officer or prosecutor who relies upon them, even though, again, 15% of exonerations from DNA evidence is based upon this false testimony and statement by these informants.
I actually have a question. I mean, does that instruction also require that the incentive that the informant has been given be disclosed?
Yes, and that is not complied with. You might have followed the news, the recent story out of Orange County in California, where for years they had this huge program of using informants, and either there was complete non-disclosure or the prosecutors in Orange County failed to disclose the benefit they were receiving. And it's this huge scandal that's blowing up all these cases in Orange County. But yeah, absolutely, they have to inform. Did they expect a benefit? Did they receive a benefit? What was the nature of that benefit? And too often that's not done.
Yeah, Yeah, Beckstein, they actually had to go to a different county and get Beckstein's like charges dropped to the hold on him and be released so he could go out and actually his wife was with him in the hotel room too while they were waiting to send him in the taxi to go talk to Mark. So Beckstein, like, I mean, he's a person that was really there. Claire, do we ever confirm like Beckstein's his real identity?
Ladies and gentlemen, Claire Gilbert.
Yeah, because because the dude had he had at least 20 aliases.
Beckstein had approximately 24 aliases.
So we don't know what his real. We don't know what his real identity is at all.
He has a lot of them. Things he a lot of like Social Security numbers.
Table.
Yeah. He had a lot of different SSN numbers. Like he had a lot of IDs to go by. So who knows.
Did they ever, now he admitted under oath that he had been, wait, was it Beckstein who admitted under, who admitted that he had been an informant in other cases? And then was it?
Beckstein denied he'd ever been an informant.
An informant, exactly. When there was proof that he was, did Joey's attorney have knowledge of that or?
Yeah, they actually did because in fact, Sutton talked to the GBI agent who used him as an informant and said, hey, this guy's gonna be informant for us now. And apparently the agent Harris, I think Eric Harris, on the phone call, like, yeah, we used him. He was great. He totally informed on these women we were trying to get for murder. So, and that wasn't stuff that the defense had. So it was pretty clear that, I mean, yeah, he was a repeat informant. Mm-hmm.
For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created weekly and are not repeated within a year. You can choose your meals from a variety of recipes or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. And you can choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. And now I'm excited to announce that Blue Apron has a new freshness guarantee. It's their promise to you, the customer, that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. If you're unable to cook with any ingredient in your delivery, no problem. You simply contact Blue Apron's customer experience team within 7 days of receiving your delivery, and they'll be happy to credit or refund your account. So, you can check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/up. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/up. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I found myself admiring the prosecutor Tammy Colston's just tortured logic in that she was having to introduce informants that that even she had no confidence in whatsoever. Then she had to bring somebody on who had now she knew was going to come on the stand and deny the thing that he'd said before. Which I mean, I give her props because she got away with it clearly. God bless her. Did she...
In Georgia, we'd say, bless your heart.
Oh, yes. Bless your heart. Bless your heart. But now, at one point, it sounded as though she was testifying, because at one point, she introduces the fact that... was it Ellis, I believe, who had... He was the one who was up for rape, and that he had been... that they had sentenced him, and he no longer now had any incentive to tell the truth, supposedly. I'm using air quotes to the podcast listeners.
I do it all the time. Like,
And so now that's why he was coming into the trial situation and lying, supposedly. But that would be evidence. I mean, did she do that in her closing statement? Or where did she introduce that?
She told the jury that, of course, he's lying now because he didn't get a deal and he's really mad at us for not getting a deal. So he's lying now. He's trying to get revenge on the state, but he was telling the truth before.
Uh-huh. And she's allowed to do that in the closing statement?
Yeah.
Really? Okay. I'm just drinking all that in. I wanted to get to some social media questions, actually. We have at Alice B. Carey, who asks, since jailhouse informant statements seem to be problematic most of the time, do any states have restrictions on admitting them as evidence, especially ones that have been recanted? Or is that on the defense attorneys to object to it?
It's a good question. I'm not aware of any states that have that.
There's no states that have a ban. There are certain states like Illinois, where I used to teach for 5 years, where they have a hearing that is pre-trial and that's the point at which the judge assesses the credibility and the consistency of the informant's statements and determines, is this a reliable enough informant to testify? California recently had some legislation that dealt with this. So there are some states that are trying to heighten that hurdle for reliability and admissibility, but there's no state that has a per se ban on informant testimony.
I have a question.
Yeah,
I learn a lot from my colleagues. Yeah, actually, the question is for Dennis, which is, I know like you've been involved in federal. He's also a lawyer, by the way. Other
yes.
than being like an.
I thought I was here to read the underwear ad.
Yeah, the underwear ad. we actually just bring him along for the tattoos. I can't do tattoos and liquor, so I got to have Dennis like hanging out with me. No, but you in federal practice also, I'm kind of curious, like what is, how are informants, I've heard that they're used pretty heavily. Like,
they are, yeah. They are. I mean, I hate to deflect, but here's really what it comes down to in the courtroom. You're trying to tell a story for the benefit of the fact finder, whether it's the judge or the jury. Either side is trying to put on the best possible story, and you pick and choose what contributes to that story. If the jailhouse snitch is the best that you have to help you tell your story, you use the jailhouse snitch, and then you just run the risk of the jury instruction and the opposing counsel shredding you in the closing argument. That's about it, and then you hope that your snitch does well on cross. That's what it comes down to. I hate that it's like that, but that's the foundation of our justice system. It's two opposing parties duking it out by telling competing versions of the same story. That's it. So, you know, I would like to see mechanisms built in to restrict those practices, because Dennis Robinson, the executive producer of Undisclosed, thinks it's screwed up, you know? But that's just the way it is right now. But I will say, though, that's also part of the reason why I'm involved with Undisclosed, is that I truly believe in our ability to enact systemic change. I think that if we get enough people on board with this stuff, we can really push for the changes that are necessary in our justice system and make it more transparent, more free, more beneficial for the sake of justice, if that makes any sense.
And I will say, one of the most disheartening parts of this for me has been talking to jurors and have them pretty much across the board tell me first, oh, they're a bunch of jailhouse informants, but we didn't pay attention to them because everyone knows they're just trying to get out of jail for a day. And I'm like, yeah, great, they realize this. And then I'd ask them like what happened, what their understanding was of what went on at the trial, or like what the state's theory was, if there was a theory. Most of them don't even know what theory was. But they all would, when they started trying to describe the facts that they thought they'd heard, they would say facts that only came from jailhouse informants. So the facts stuck in their brain. They told themselves, they told me, of course that they're lying. We're not going to listen to jailhouse informants. But those facts came in, and the facts stuck in their brain, and they couldn't necessarily know where each fact came from. So that the story was there. That's all they needed them for, was the story.
And that's not unlawful. It's not even unethical. A good lawyer preps his or her witnesses, right? I mean, so unethical. Yeah, me sitting up here is like, yeah, it's really screwed up. It's unethical.
But legally,
like a lawyer, you prep your witnesses, right? You show them the statements that they made on paper or the interviews that they did, and they said, hey, it would be really cool if when you're on the stand, you said this. And I'm going to ask you this, and then you're going to say this. Cool? And then when they get on cross... To some degree. I mean, it happens. Well, you can't direct them what to say, but I mean, you're basically highlighting portions of their statement. You're saying, like, this is the stuff that I'm going to ask you about, all right? It'd be cool if you remembered this. That's just the practice of it. That's the way lawyering works in the courtroom.
Or if you're in Floyd County, you just give them a copy of the transcript and let them take it with them to the stand. That was Adam Elrod, though, and he really needed the help, so...
Well, actually, our next thing is from Beth Schultz, who says, I don't even understand how the jailhouse snitch ploy works on a jury anywhere, yet it obviously does. Do people seriously think that an accused murderer still awaiting trial will spontaneously confess to a complete stranger, and not just confess, but provide details of the crime? It defies all logic and common sense. And I believe that people just, we get our knowledge when we're in on a jury, we get our knowledge from the movies. And you'd buy that in a movie, sort of. I think that as you were saying, unfortunately, so much of the system is now leaving it on the shoulders of the defense attorney and then the juries to judge these things, there's no other way to fix that other than by educating the juries.
A couple of weeks ago, Kathleen Zellner, who represents Stephen Avery, and you know, she not too long ago filed a motion to have the DNA evidence retested in the case, tweeted out, I thought it was interesting, and she's a great advocate because she uses social media really smart, because she's telling the folks in Wisconsin, I know what to expect and everybody's watching you. But she tweeted out, I won't be surprised now if jailhouse informants come forward. Now that we're reexamining the evidence, like, she's expected that. And I've had people at different at an Innocence Project, actually, when Adnan's conviction was overturned, say, listen, this is the time you have to be, like, he has to be really careful, because it's common practice for the state to go looking for informants, like, when they're up against a wall. And it's kind of terrifying. As somebody who is in that position, you don't know who's going to say what for what incentive. And there's almost no protection against it, I feel like.
It's horrible, but the foundation of our republic is on giving the case to the fact finder, giving the case to the jury, and just believing in our hearts that moral, reasonable people are going to make the right decision. They're going to see the wheat, and they're going to see the chaff, and they're going to decide the wheat. That doesn't always happen, and that sucks, but that's just the way it is, you know?
Speaking of of our republic, we got one at Jail Whitaker who says, what direction do you think justice reform will go now, given that we've got a new administration? Wow.
Good thing this is a podcast, because you should see our faces.
Yes, Colin, do you have any thoughts?
I was going to say, the one thing that I wish had gotten more attention, and it did get some, but the fact that to this day, the president-elect is saying that 5 innocent teenagers should have been executed for a crime they were exonerated for. I think that gives us a very frightening idea of what how the DOJ is going to go and what their view is going to be on exonerations.
Yes, and I had some hope because the Democratic side had a part of their platform as there was reenfranchisement for felons,
yes,
for voting rights, and they had a lot of ideas that I thought were very worthwhile pursuing. So I was very frustrated that that did not come to pass.
That is huge. The number of people who were straight up disenfranchised is far greater than any gap between the votes.
But obviously the Department of Justice and the justice system is huge. It's goes across America. So there's I feel like on a local level there's so much happening and so many changes happening, and with the conviction integrity units in different states. Does the federal system cause, does it have to be something that sweeps across the nation, or on a local level, does that come into play more often than not, Colin?
Yeah, well, I think overall, if you're looking at the picture, you're going to see criminal justice reform be based upon economics. So there were some candidates who won who campaigned on getting rid of mandatory minimums, advocating for shorter prison time. And so that's something where bipartisan support says, if you're looking at the state's finances or the federal government's finances, it's better to have shorter prison terms. On the other hand, stocks for private prisons skyrocketed after Trump was elected. And the momentum there had been that the current regime was essentially getting rid of private prisons at the federal level, with essentially state private prisons to follow suit. And that's something where the economics support private prisons, and therefore you're likely to see the progress on that slow down. We had marijuana legalized in some states, and it seems there's some momentum on that, and that has, again, economic consequences. So again, I would imagine the next 4 years, when you're looking at it, both at the state and federal level, you're going to see criminal justice reform that is supportive of state and the federal economy, and anything that cuts against that is less likely to get momentum.
Can I add that, as somebody in my position, Muslim, who, since the election last week, I've been getting questions about the Muslim registry. I mean, my concern now, I mean, not obviously I'm concerned about all these issues, but also is the criminalization of heretofore protected activities, right? So the idea that there will be ideological tests, that if I fail, I might actually end up being held accountable, as a criminal for something. I mean, we know beforehand, and also I practiced immigration law for a long time, and immigration powers can have a real impact. And immigration powers, it's not just about, those people can, you end up in detention. That detention sometimes isn't those private prisons. It's in, it's they're housed with state level prisoners, sometimes in federal prisons. It all kind of ties in together. These things are not you can't kind of parse them out. So I think if the administration really cracks down on immigration violations, if they criminalize behavior, if they start a registry, this is all going to play together. And I think given, I mean, I spent much of the last 18 months thinking, hoping, rhetoric, maybe it's just campaigning, but just given the kinds of potential cabinet appointments we're seeing, I'm really wondering if it might come to pass. If they registered me and take me to a camp, you know, somebody rescue me. Susan Simpson, break me out. I will give you my cat until you until I can get out.
I was gonna say, I don't remember offhand now what state it was, but there was an elected official today who was trying to promote having paid protesting be criminalized.
Yes. Oh, yes. That was a, I believe, in Washington State. Yeah, a state senator was looking to do that. I don't. Yeah. And by the way, there's no proof that any protester has ever been paid at all.
Mm-hmm. It was proven to be a fake story. It came out in the news in the Washington Post today. It was that it was a guy who was promoting a fake news story about paying protesters. Yes. It's all BS.
And it's slightly good news, though. Georgia decided to someone in Georgia decided to introduce a bill that would not let you wear burkas in Georgia. And they very, very quickly revoked, so they took that down, so it's not going to happen. That apparently still aligned too far, thank God.
Yeah, it was a confusing election in many ways, obviously, the pot legalization, but also the several sort of law and order prosecutors got voted out of office, which I thought, wow, I'm getting a mixed message, mm-hmm. America. What are you doing to me?
Confusing John Cryer.
Confusing John Cryer. Yeah. I wanted to thank you all for coming so much. We are actually going to take questions from the audience. So we'll take questions about Joey, about Adnan, about how the show is made, whatever you want to ask. So we're going to send Veronica and John out to the audience.
Two quick things before we do. One, I know we need to go to Claire.
Oh, yes.
And we do have a question on social media, too. So I'll go to Claire first, and then we'll do the one online question, then we'll do audience.
Yes, Claire from the Georgia Innocence Project wanted to remind everybody. Yes.
Don? Oh, Don, you're supposed to read Claire's thing?
Well, yes. What it was we wanted to remind everybody you can donate to the Georgia Innocence Project, and you can do it now by texting the word Joey to 91999. All y'all, you got your phones. They're right here. You can just do it right now. but thank you. That is a donation to the Georgia Innocence Project. It'll help the Georgia Innocence Project fight to free Joey Watkins and their other clients as well. And it is tax deductible. So, you know, it makes it super easy to donate to Georgia Innocence Project.
91999.
Yes, 91999. And the word is Joey. Yeah. If you've got any questions, we would love to hear them.
And can I just say, the amount of work that GIP is doing on, like, calling it a shoestring budget is, like, really overly fair to shoestrings, because they were working out of a nail salon when I first met them. Like, you had power by then, I think. I'm not sure you had internet yet.
No heat,
but you did have power by that point. They hadn't had it before. And they were, they have a lot of cases, and there are a lot of cases in Georgia that need attention, not just Joey. Joey is not, there are lots of people like Joey right now, and they can do a lot of great work if they have the resources to do it.
And that's why we're asking not just people in this room, but anyone that is watching or listening, if you could just pick up your phone now and text Joey to 91999 and just donate $5. That's all we're asking, is $5. But if everyone who is listening or watching this right now donates $5 to the Georgia Innocence Project, our budget will be set for the next year, and we'll be able to hire another attorney, to help us work these cases, and that would be absolutely fantastic.
It's pretty cool to see all these people doing, like, picking up
the
phone.
That's
awesome. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
I left my phone in the... I would, but...
One last time, it's text Joey to 91999. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So one question, and then I'll go right over here from So Call Me Katie 11. I feel the facts of this case are too absurd to believe. Have you all been able to contact any of the jurors?
Yes, I've tried to speak to the jurors. And I mean, to some extent, I've almost found it not unfair, but there have been a lot of comments online about how could the jury possibly believe this? Or, like, I mean, people even like, how stupid is this jury? That's not what the problem was here. That's not what happened. It wasn't that there was a bunch of stupid jurors. Because quite honestly, I think a lot of people on that jury would have had the same exact verdict. it wasn't the jury that failed, it was the system. Because the jury sat there and listened to a lot of people get up there and tell a lot of stories about what a bad, bad person Joey was and about all the terrible things he'd done, and with no apparent reason to lie. And that's really persuasive evidence when you don't combat all these, like, how on earth could, it's totally not possible that a police department could get that many kids up there to lie about all this crazy stuff. That's not real. That's impossible. And that's not an unfair like conclusion to reach. So, and also remember what you're hearing on the show isn't just what the jury heard. You're also hearing what was in the police notes, which the Finns didn't have, as well as like more recent investigations. So this is, what you're hearing on the show is, one, what was testified to, and two, the impeachment. For a lot of the witnesses in this case, only one was there, and the reasons why it was all bogus never came in.
I want to tag on to what Susan said, because one thing that she said was really important. It was that the system failed, right? And I don't intend to diminish Joey Watkins' case, but there are thousands of Joey Watkins across this country, and that's what drives me nuts. How many wrongful conviction podcasts are taking on that work right now? We've got Bob Ruff at Truth and Justice looking at dozens of cases right now. And, you know, it would be great, and I'm sure she will. Susan is going to work to overturn Joey Watkins' conviction. I mean, the whole team is, but what really matters is this systemic change. I mean, that's really what we need. And I hope that that's what Undisclosed does, is that it compels our huge audience to try to persuade legislators to make changes, because that's what really matters, is the systemic effect. And I think that's what we got to focus on.
And if you haven't already, listen to Brooke's podcast, Brooke Gooding's podcast, Actual Innocence, where she covers all these cases where people, women and men, who have been exonerated, but their stories are often just as crazy.
Brooke of Actual Innocence, where are you?
Where'd
you
go?
Yes. Hey, Brooke.
And I believe there was a question over there. Can we get a microphone? Just throw it at her.
First of all, I have to say, I have giggled loud at the underwear commercials. Dennis Robinson, when you were an addendum or addenda, I don't know how you call it.
We don't know.
But you were, it was hysterical. But okay, so here's the question. You talk a lot about changing the criminal justice system. Here's your magic wand. You talk about like we should change it, but what do you mean by that? Like, what? Here's your magic wand. How do you change it?
Oh, that's so good.
We're so smart.
You know.
Why don't we figure out how to change
it? It's a challenge.
It?
Colin.
Well. He is the professor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Passing it off to him.
Yeah, I mean, number one, you need to increase funding to public defenders' offices. That is the endemic problem. 80% of defendants in this country have public defenders, 90% in capital cases, and these public defenders are overwhelmed with the number of cases. So that is sort of ground zero of where the crisis starts. So better funding to public defenders' offices, and then more open discovery. You need to have a freer flow of information, because so many of these, both wrongful convictions after trial, but more importantly, there have been Supreme Court cases that have really limited the amount of discovery a defendant is entitled to before they accept a plea bargain or plead guilty. We really need to fundamentally change the way, whether based upon precedent or just prosecutors' offices stepping up and giving that information to the defense early in the process so they can see their options and decide what they need to do. So those are the first two things I would hit right away, is funding of public defenders' offices and broadening discovery rules.
I'll tag on a couple. I don't quite know how to approach this because I think it's a cultural problem, but we have to find a way to disincentivize wins versus losses in the court system. I mean, it's an adversarial system, and I hate to steal from Winston Churchill and his quote about democracy. It's like the best worst form of seeking justice, you know, the adversarial system. But I don't think that it should be the role of prosecutors to win cases. I think it should be the role of prosecutors to administer justice. But right now, most prosecutors are elected, and for the most part, they're elected based on their ability to win cases. And that requires a cultural shift. I'll say the same thing about judges. I'm just not a fan of elected judgeship. It's just, to some degree, you're placating the whims of the populist mass, you know? And I think appointments are a better system, because you're more likely to get judges who are looking to seek just results despite the fact that you might achieve unpopular outcomes, you know? So those are the two I would tackle.
Bob Ruff right now on Truth and Justice, I mean, he's like exploring cases out of Smith County, Texas. And in one of the episodes I heard not long ago, I'm a little behind, sorry, Bob. But he mentioned that in the particular county where these cases are coming out of, if the prosecutors lose three cases, they lose their job. I mean, that is like, you know, that gives so much incentive to rend and break the rule. I mean, like, do what you need to do to get the win. Now, I'm not a very vengeful person, but what I would tack on is that I feel really strongly that accountability measures need to be put in place. California recently, I think they passed a legislation where they make Brady violations, which everybody should know about because Colin has talked about 100 times. that, you know, when you willfully, when you are withholding evidence that's exculpatory willingly, that, you know, that is actually a felony. And so, I mean, that is a measure that, you know, if you want checks and balances, that's how you get checks. It's like, how do you hold prosecutors who, you know, you have prosecutors who become judges, Colston, and others, like, how do you hold people accountable if they can just get away with being, you know, unethical or using the rules, you know, not in the fair way?
But that's chicken and the egg when it comes to our democracy, is that the accountability is built into voting for these prosecutors, right? And I'm not proposing a solution. I'm just saying that's kind of where we stand right now. And I think it requires a cultural shift, like just a revisit of how we see the adversarial system at large.
Yes, my dumb idea was the whole one police idea. There's a lot of support amongst you guys, clearly. But just the idea that we have 18 overlapping different police agencies and organizations, and they feud over who's got who can have a case, and we have elected sheriffs. And if you've listened to the In the Dark podcast, that's a big eye opener in terms of the I am embarrassed to say I did not even know what the sheriff in Los Angeles does. I have no idea. He's a lovely guy, but I feel like I don't understand why we have multi overlapping bureaucracies. It doesn't seem like it makes any sense to me. But also Susan had the wonderful idea of providing jurors with transcripts at the end of the day. Which I think you're wincing.
I'm not saying that would work perfectly, because I can see issues too, but I just don't think it's realistic or fair to expect. I mean, there's no way I could ever listen through a trial and then like go back and be like, yeah, I know what happened. Because without being able to compare and go back, you really can't reach a. Human minds don't work that way.
Mine certainly doesn't. Do we have any other questions? Okay, in the back.
Yeah. Yes. Hi. Thank you. First off, like, apparently all of the podcasts that I listen to are here now. So, like, this is the greatest thing ever. You guys are my drive to work. But so my question is, it sounds like between this one and, like, you know, I've been listening to Breakdown as well at your, you know, suggestion. And it sounds like there's a lot of testimony that can come in based on, you know, character issues and whatnot. And it sounds like this all started from one person's dislike of Joey and gathered a lot of other people's dislike of Joey. So my question is really, have you been able to reconnect with Brianne or any of those folks? And kind of how will that, we haven't really heard about her for a while. So I was wondering what's going on with that, if anything.
Yeah, Brianne, Claire did speak to Brianne early on, I think probably December or November of 2015. And she was not interested in speaking anymore. We did try and reach out to her. We never heard back. So I assume she's decided not to comment, which is understandable. Other witnesses in the case have similarly not wanted to, like Adam Elrod didn't want to talk to me. He said, like, I don't want to talk to you. I kept asking questions, tried to keep him on the phone. He's like, did you not hear me the first time? So that was the end of that. And then Chad Redden, we tried to talk to. I think we had some hope there, because he was, there was like, it seemed like at first he was going to talk. And then I think he sent Claire like an angry text saying, like, what was it?
We had received signs from a few people that he would be willing to talk with us, so we reached out to him and he just made it clear.
Yeah, so that was that. So no, unfortunately, the key witnesses in the case, for the most part, they don't want to talk.
I should mention, we haven't done it yet, but Susan went to Emory and recorded an addendum episode that we're hoping to use at some point in the next couple of months in front of an evidence class and character issues, or relevance issues under 403 and character issues under Colin 600 series. For witnesses, sorry. That all comes up. Like, they talk about that from a not yet lawyer perspective in a way that helps the audience understand it. So we're looking to broadcast that whenever, I think, 8th with your...
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So we're looking to broadcast that in December. So I think it'll explain it a lot better around that time.
I also just want to comment that I think it's really rare to find if you revisit cases, like find witnesses who now just want to, or anybody who wants to like go back to that time and talk about it again. I think in a lot of cases, people are just done. They're done. They don't want to go back there. They don't especially want to revisit. They don't want to even consider the fact that maybe they got something wrong, or maybe they helped further a result that was an unjust result. I mean, in Adnan's case, we've had, you know, the folks who've done the investigative have had a lot of trouble, including, you know, some of us, but getting people just don't want to talk. It's really interesting. They don't want to go back there.
A lot of the witnesses I have talked to clearly didn't want to, but they, for whatever reason, decided that they decided to talk to us, and I'm very grateful for that, but it was very clear it was not easy for them, and they kind of wish it could have been avoided, but they felt like they had an obligation or some sense of wanting to explain things. But none of them, it's not fun. It was terrible back then, it's terrible now.
Any other questions? Okay.
Hi. I was wondering whether any of the informants were given polygraphs, and if that's even any kind of tool that is used to gauge the reliability of informants or snitches.
Not in this case, but it doesn't mean anything.
In the practice that I've observed, polygraphs nowadays are more so used to try to get a suspect to flip. Like, polygraphs they're not reliable in court. You can't use them in court as for veracity evidence. Just from what I've seen, polys are now so used where you'll take a suspect who just doesn't know what's up, you'll hook them up to it and say, all right, we know you're lying and this machine's going to prove it. And then they're like, all right, well, I'm hooked up to the machine, I might as well confess. That's how polys are used nowadays.
Yeah, pressure tactic, not really.
A useful tool.
Yeah.
Hi, I actually was an investigator for the prosecutor's office in New Jersey for 7.5 years. So I'm wondering, like you said, there is not one police, there is not one way that we all do it. For me, I was with the sex abuse rape assault unit. In Georgia, is there not an investigator? What I was tasked with to do was basically take the police's file and go back and research and make sure they actually crossed their T's and dotted every single I before we let anyone come into the court. So is Georgia not set up that way like New Jersey is?
There was an investigator for the DA. He did Harkness.
Hey, Claire. Let me just come to you.
Yeah, so the John Harkins, there was an investigator for the DA's office. He did interview witnesses.
Podcasting is funny because Claire's got this look on her face like, what? But everybody listening can't see it.
In my head, I'm thinking Claire's thinking something. I know she is, but I'm like, there's a whole backstory.
It sounds like a fantastic idea, but yeah. I don't think it was done.
But Harkins did go through and talk to a lot of witnesses, and I've heard interesting stories about what happened there too.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was necessarily a check on the police.
It was
though.
Not a check. That was not what it was.
Sign of that.
We've got so many. Okay.
Hi, I'm sorry, I have to be a little bit catty and I have to go back to Brianne. I've got so many questions about Brianne. So a couple things. One, you guys started the season saying that Joey is not like your typical nice guy. He's not going to be an easy person to bring up. And Brianne made some pretty strong assault charges against him. And I want to know if Joey's responded to them or puts any validity in them. And also, if you found any connection between Brianne and law enforcement or anything, because she seems to have a really inside knowledge of how the system works.
No, Joey, all the physical abuse claims that she's made, Joey is totally denied. No one's ever seen them. There's no witnesses. There's no evidence beyond what Brianne has said. And there's no way that's what we have right now. And there are lots of reasons people who are abused don't come forward. So you have to look at it as a whole. In this case, there is no supporting evidence, and there are situations that in some cases there should have been. But now, he was verbally abusive. I've
seen witness statements describing like him yelling at her, things like that. But as far as the claims like the shotgun and the bleach thrown in the shower, that's where we are. We have those claims and that's what we're left with. But no, Joey has denied all of that.
I mean, you have to be very careful in these kinds of cases. I mean, there are, you know, it's not uncommon that victims of either domestic violence or intimate partner violence aren't able to provide evidence of it. I will say, though, that the fact that it's not just that Brianne wasn't able to, Brianne wasn't able to provide evidence, but also that I don't think there's a, you can recognize any kind of pattern that Joey was like this with any other
yes.
girlfriend. So, I think that also, you know, we have to weigh that in too.
I will say one thing I wish I addressed in the podcast and didn't. You hear at one point in the Kelly Robinson's tape when Sutton's talking to her, he says, I've talked to six other girls and they've all said the same thing about what he's done to them. I don't want you to be the next one that he does this to. That's not, as far as I can tell, there's no basis for that. I've talked to ex-girlfriends, and not one of them's ever said he's been abusive. Aslan Hogue, the girl he was dating at the time that Isaac was murdered, her parents filed a stalking warrant alleging he like called her, and so there's that, and that's there is one case there, but that's not like physically abusive. There's no other witness who said that, and like Erica, who dated both Isaac and Joey, has said that Joey, there's never any abusive tendencies that she ever saw when she was with him.
Hi, so my question pertains to a past episode. I think one of the things I found most absurd about this case was that Joey was apparently the leader of a very violent gang terrorizing the streets of Rome. And my question is there an actual FBI definition of a gang? Could me and my three friends be considered a gang terrorizing the streets of Bethesda, Maryland? I mean, I just really want to know. I was really, really shocked that that was considered a gang. Him, one other person, another person he didn't really even know that well.
More than two. And then also pattern of conduct. But yeah, more than two.
Yeah, the federal definition
most law enforcement agencies use a defined criteria, but it's mostly for statistical tracking. So, for example, if they want to track gang violence in a certain jurisdiction or whatever, it's got to fit that defined criteria. I don't know if that's public. I know in terrorism cases.
There is a definition, and I can't remember the rule. It's 133 or something. I can't remember. So that's wrong. Don't do that. there is a defined criteria, and they hit all the points they needed to in that report from the FBI. Yeah,
and it doesn't necessarily have legal weight. Colin, and you could check me on that.
I mean,
it's jurisdictional. It's mostly for stats tracking. Yeah, unfortunately, I doubt the FBI looked at them as a gang.
Well, so one thing that Corey Jacobs told me, and he's Sutton's nephew, he's the Home Depot parking lot guy, is that he I don't know if it's true. He says that Sutton went to the FBI and trained there at some point. So, is that yeah?
I think that's true. I think it's in his post. Well, I don't know if he went to the FBI and trained there, but it's in his post records, which is a list of all his training records that he was trained by the FBI.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of training it was. Apparently, he had some stint in the FBI.
I'm just going to hazard a guess. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations has a training academy, I think outside of Atlanta, that the FBI comes down and does courses for. And I know by virtue of proximity, like geographic proximity, that Georgia sends a lot of its police department through those courses. So it might have been something remote. But it's always like in law enforcement cases like that, the law enforcement is going to make itself try to sound like more sexy or just like bolster its credentials, because it'll help out when you're on the stand, or it'll help out when you're trying to investigate like a joint case. Like, well, I worked with the FBI, I'm Captain Badass, you know. But it's we should only lend that the credibility that it deserves, and oftentimes it doesn't deserve that credibility, and I think we see that in Sutton's case.
Hi, I just had a quick question. So I know you guys have covered this in past episodes, but what are the legal avenues at this point? I know previously you had said there's very limited legal avenues to solve this for Joey, or where he has some chances here in court. So if you can maybe talk a little bit about that without, you know, I know legal strategy is something you guys are probably keeping close to the vest, but any sort of options at this point, roads that he can travel down?
The options are limited. It's a very, very high burden at this stage. And there are a few, like, depending on what kind of facts are in a case like this, there are a few routes you can go. And, you know, it's, there's nothing that it doesn't, I can't imagine any evidence you could find that would be easy at this point. Like, there's no, I can't even think of what evidence would be like the magic ticket, because there isn't any, like, there's nothing that could be that compelling to, you know, like, well, yep, that's game over, we're done here. Because every witness could recant wouldn't mean anything. I mean, we could have more people saying, oh yeah, I heard this guy confessing. That wouldn't mean anything, because that's happened a lot in this case already. But there are routes, and the GIP is working very hard to find a way forward here.
I'm just going to add that where there is Susan, there is a way.
Yes.
I have...
Zazzle, if you're listening, T-shirts now.
I feel very hopeful that that we're gonna find a way. I'm not we. Susan's gonna find a way. We just tag along for the glory.
Like Anand's attorney Doug said, there's always room for hope.
Yeah. There's some questions.
I know you all had an event in Rome just in the past couple of weeks. I'm really interested to know what have been the impacts in Rome. I mean, either anecdotally, or do you have any sort of data in terms of how many people are actually listening to this in Rome? And do you have any kind of gauge of what popular opinion is now, or has, you know, opinion shifted in the, you know, the court of, you know, public opinion in Rome?
The guy at the coffee shop knows my name now.
She waits in the coffee
shop.
Yeah, I
do. They've got, it's a pretty cool coffee shop. There's like one, so I'm always there between like interviews trying to like wait for someone to call me. I will say it's gotten... So we had two meetups this past week. We had one in Atlanta and then one in Rome. And they're both great. And a lot of people came out to one in Atlanta downtown, midtown. And it was great to have everyone there. But a stark difference that I noticed, I found interesting, was that at the Rome meetup, we had people showing up like... from their jobs, like wearing like their coveralls from like their job at the auto shop, and like their nurse tags still on. So it was a very different kind of crowd, and it was very much people in the community who were concerned about what they were hearing and like coming straight from work and wanting to know more about like what in God Almighty happened in their town.
Floyd County's paying attention, right?
Yeah. Thing I would add to that is that when I was walking over here this evening, I got a call from the Rome News Tribune, which is the major newspaper in Rome, and we've had a bit of a hard time getting them involved. I think they maybe did one story on Joey's case recently and then briefly covered a meetup, but they're going to do what sounds like a pretty big story on Sunday, mainly around the lawsuit about the trial tapes, and then a little bit about Joey's future legal options. So that's fantastic to get the newspaper interested, and there's a lot more people in the local community interested now than there ever was before. And we also got some feedback, Susan and I did at the meetup, that attorneys in Rome are starting to pay a lot of attention to this podcast and are quite horrified by what they're hearing, which is a very good sign.
And I've been able to talk to a lot of witnesses. And I'm, again, like, I've been surprised continually, people that I didn't expect to want to come forward that have, and have felt a lot, have listened to the podcast, pay attention, and feel horrified by what happened, and feel guilt, even where no guilt's deserved, about them not knowing what was going on. I mean, they couldn't have known, but that sense of guilt definitely is with a lot of them. But I have not been able to talk. I've had off-the-record conversations with some of Rome police, and that ended, and no one else, no Floyd County officers, no one in the DA's office, no one in authority is going to talk to me.
We tried. We have time for two more questions, and then I think Methil has some follow-up questions that came in online. So I know I was standing next to here, and then I'll go up to the front.
Okay.
And I know you guys will be available after.
Arm is pulled. Okay, so first.
I'll go this lady first, and I'll come right up.
Hi, so I'm a forensic psychology student at George Washington University, and in my children and adolescents in the justice system class, the first thing we learn is how developmentally different juveniles are from adults and how that plays a role in the justice system. So since Adnan and Joey and their friends were all juveniles at the time of the alleged offense, and the witnesses' statements really incriminated and eventually led to the conviction of both of them, how do you think police can better tailor maybe their interrogation tactics or how they handle juveniles, since this led to a conviction of both people who we believe aren't guilty? So how do you think that police can better handle juveniles in the justice system, so this doesn't keep happening.
I'll note that Joey was actually, he was 19 at the time this happened, so he was not a juvenile.
Technically. I mean, still pretty.
I would not call his brain fully developed that time.
I think it's important to note that juvenile exonerations, and I'm talking, when I say exoneration, that means it's been proven that this person is innocent of a crime, 38% of them falsely confessed. Those juveniles, like, that is how vulnerable they are to, like, interrogation and pressure and fatigue and all these things. And something as simple as making sure there's a parent or an attorney in the room, giving them access to an attorney before they're even read their Miranda rights. I mean, these are the kinds of things. Other countries have these protections in place. You know, they have, I can't remember, these special advocates who, like, you know, step in and make sure that juvenile has, you know, the legal protections, and they understand these, but we don't have these in place yet. Yeah,
I think the most prominent example in all of our minds is obviously Brendan Dassey, because you watch Making a Murderer and you're like, what the hell? Is this America? How is that possible? But in my opinion, Jeff Deskovich's story is by far the best story of a juvenile interrogation. Brooke did it on episode 8. Yeah, somewhere around there. So listen to Actual Innocence episode 8 with Jeff Deskovich. There are different interviewing interrogation techniques that police use. Like, for example, and I want to say this in the most respectful way possible, when interviewing a victim of sexual assault, there is a very specific and scientifically verifiable forensic examination that should occur and kind of outlines what types of questions you should ask in order not to re-traumatize the victim and in order to get the evidence that you want. In my opinion, there should be a similar process for juvenile defendants. The problem therein is that most police, most prosecutors, and I'd say the public at large, thinks, well, if this person's capable of committing an adult crime, then they're capable of submitting themselves to an adult interrogation, and that's how we're going to treat them. And that's false. That isn't the way it should be. And again, that requires a cultural shift. But I would be a proponent of specific and tailored forensic interrogations of juveniles of a certain age and of a certain mindset in order to get to the truth, not to get them to confess. But unfortunately, the system right now is built to get them to confess, and that's just the way it is.
And it's not just the defendants, because it's a blurry line, because in this case, especially, like, who's the defendant and who is a witness? I mean, you don't know until you find out who's going to start talking and confessing to you, like Josh. But they told quite a few of the kids, the teenagers in this case. They were all, like, under 20 and younger. They were young. And they told many of them, like, if I find out you were lying, I'm going to come back and charge you for conspiracy to commit murder. So at that time, I'm technically a witness, but the same techniques are being used on them that could have led to a false confession.
Yeah.
So I just... Is this working?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I just had to test it out. When you were talking with the jurors earlier, I was thinking about back in near the beginning of the podcast when you were discussing with Joey about how the big turn of event was the dogs and dog killing and whatnot. Did any of the jurors touch on that? As prior law enforcement, that was really interesting. All of them?
The dogs were it was always pretty much a script when I talked. Well, actually, that's not true. There was one juror who wasn't really, one juror thought it was a hog. but for the most part, like, overwhelmingly, like, I talked to them, like, oh yeah, I remember that case. They killed dogs, and the cell phone proved they did it.
You just offer yourself as a resource to us. So you're prior law enforcement. Can you just give your thoughts on, like, listen to the podcast and what you think? And some background on who you are. Just, we have, a few minutes. Sorry.
So with Sutton, I actually used to work at Quantico, so I know that the FBI Academy, a lot of officers come there for resources in gang violence and things like that. So as you were saying, 2+ is considered a gang. You know, it's very minimal, but yes.
It's not a very powerful
yes.
gang.
It's not. There's your power in numbers.
We're a gang.
As a prior officer, it's a very interesting case to learn about how they got this evidence and how they talked to these individuals, especially juveniles and whatnot. It's an eye-opener. I mean, this is back in 90s, in 2000, so it was right around the time that... that this all occurred, and Adnan's story, and she got me hooked on it, and I'm like, how is all this possible? Yeah. Why is this possible? Yeah. So it's definitely interesting. And coming from Georgia, you hit on Paulding County. My family lives in Paulding County.
I hope I got the county right, but didn't apologize to Paulding.
No, it's hilarious. It's just the ties. And we're like, we're going to go visit Rome.
Thanks for sharing, man. Thanks for listening.
So I think Methil has a couple, yeah.
Methil has a couple more we'll social up. Media questions.
Methil Tilhan.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, by the way. This is a face to the name.
All right, so you guys already answered one of the questions from Katie Suzanne. She's the one who asked about the jurors and whether or not they had been contacted. So she had a couple of follow-ups. She says, I guess more of what I was asking was whether jurors have said whether there was just so much information introduced at trial versus one specific story being overwhelmingly persuasive, i.e., what was introduced that made them think that Joey was guilty? Also, what was so different regarding some of evidence at Mark's trial versus Joey's?
We'll get into the latter one later in the episode. It's a complex issue, and I think there's not really one theory on what happened differently or what explains different verdicts. I am inclined to think that Mark just got lucky. I don't necessarily think there was a different, it's different jury, different set. And you know, you get one strong personality on the jury who says, there's no real evidence here, I'm not moving, and she can convince the rest of them. But there were differences in the trials, which could also explain it too. Like, there were significant differences. Fred Simpson, the prosecutor in Mark's trial, did not call the same witnesses, didn't have the same tactics. So it's not really a scientific study here about what was different. As for the jurors, yeah, it seems that I think 90% of them all said dogs and cell phone. And then they start talking and remember more. So after they think about the case a bit, they remember more about what happened. But like their first memories, before they start to like go back all the way, it's almost always those two things. And then they start talking about, oh, he pulled a shotgun on Brianne. Or all his buddies were terrible too, and they were covering up for him. Which that one I'm still confused about, because like, dude didn't have anyone covering for him. They were all like talking whatever they could. But the fact that a lot of people came from jail and they had like minor-ish records, and for like, they seem like bad people, and he's hanging with bad people, and there's all these stories. I think it mostly comes down to they could not conceive of a reason that all these kids would lie. That just seemed beyond belief to them.
So, John, if it's up to you, if you want to do one more or not. Otherwise, I was told Methil said to
we got
to
wrap this up, folks. I did want to direct your attention to Patrick in the back. Patrick is the Cortez. He does the music to the show. we're so grateful for.
One more point from Claire.
Yes, one more point from Claire, actually.
For every one of you who picked up your phones and texted Joey to 91999, and for those of you who are listening and going to watch this live who do the same, they all pop up on my phone here, and I can see, and I'm going to try not to cry, but I am so grateful, and I'm humbled and honored.
Talking to the mic.
Thank you for supporting our cause.
Yes, thank you to the Georgia Innocence Project. Thank you all for coming tonight. We are so grateful that you made the time and you traveled from near and far, I'm sure. And please listen to, we'll have another addendum next Thursday and another new episode dropping on Monday of next week. So thank you for coming, and thank you to New America once again.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.